Good morning. I'm Karen Inkelis. I'm the director of the Center for Advanced Study of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education here in the Curry School. Welcome to Bavaro. The title of this session is entitled Designing an Applied Curriculum, Student Learning Beyond the Classroom Walls, and it's my pleasure to serve as presider this morning. We have three very dynamic and interesting presentations, and I'm going to go ahead and let our presenters introduce themselves as well as the titles of their work. All of them, however, relate to ways in which academic topics become infused with the broader world around them, facilitating heightened student learning as a result. Just to let you know the agenda for the session, each presentation will last approximately 10 to 12 minutes with a maximum of 15 minutes. After all three sets of presenters have spoken, then we'll open the floor for questions from the audience. Are there any questions about the session before we go ahead and get started? Without further ado, then, let's have our first presentation, Sustainability at Sea.
Thank you, Karen. So my name is Mark White, and I'm a professor at the Commerce School. And in spring of 2010, I was the academic dean for Semester at Sea, which is our program that's sponsored by UVA that sails around the world. My co-presenters, cohorts in crime, are our Erin Webb. She's a third-year student at the Commerce School now. She sailed with me on Semester at Sea and was responsible for part of the survey and working on the Sustainability Council. And Sarah Peterson, who is a fourth-year politics major, who after we returned actually used some of the instrument that we had used there on a Harrison Award that she conducted in Germany afterwards. So I wanted to show some of the follow-up. So Sustainability at Sea, changes in latitudes, changes in attitudes, with homage to Jimmy Buffett. So this is humanity. There's an awful lot of us right now. In fact, I've been alive for about 50 years, and this is what's happened over that time. Population has doubled, food supplies have tripled, energy use has quadrupled, and economic activity has quintupled over that time. During the same period of time, of course, the planet has remained relatively constant in mass, sextillion tons, about six times sextillion tons at the time. And what you'll see is that we've had a decline in a lot of natural resources. This is the North Atlantic cod fishery, but the same pattern could be seen in water supplies, in soil fertility, in neodymium. Okay, what we're seeing is that we're facing actually kind of a funnel. We are here, and as we go forth across time, this margin for error narrows. Okay, this is one of the basic slides I use to argue that we are facing a sustainability crisis. I teach classes in sustainable business, sustainable commerce in many different facets of the university, and I'm very, very, very concerned about this. So a few years ago, when Lee Grossman and Milton Adams invited me to become the academic dean of Semester at Sea, I had two questions. First, could I pick the time, could I pick the semester, because I wanted my family and my children to sail with me. And second, could I pick the theme, because I was very, very concerned about the challenges of a sustainable future. I believe this is indeed the key challenge facing our young people today. And if I was going to get to be the dean for one semester, like the greatest job in the world, you get to give it back. Could I design an integrated curriculum that might address this issue? And so we did. And so we had the opportunity to sail around the world, 26,000 miles in 109 days, visiting 15 ports in 10 countries. At the same time, we had 580 students sailing with us, 32 faculty, 90 classes, and 250 field practicums, so very much a hands-on program. The theme of the voyage, as I said, I got to choose, so we called it One Earth, One Future. And we had to define sustainability. And we did this, it's one of my favorite definitions, is a society of permanence. Okay, that is a world in which humanity ensures its well-being across the generations. And the idea was to design an integrated curriculum such that students would walk away from this voyage with a better understanding of the challenges we face and the solutions that could be used to implement them. I was particularly concerned about trying to see what might happen to students' worldviews over time. In the 1970s, there was a fair amount of research, sociological research actually, a fellow named Dunlap and Van Leer wrote these first papers where they identified what was the dominant social paradigm, which is essentially unlimited growth and belief that technology will save us. And he recognized in the 1970s that there was a change in worldview that seemed to be happening, going on. If you recall this Earth Day 1970, all the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Amendments in 1972, it was the kind of the decade of the environment. And he argued that people were perhaps acquiring a more ecological worldview, that is a world in which there were limits. You think of the Small is Beautiful book that came out at that particular time. And we summarized this particular worldview as a spaceship Earth view. We've got one planet, one future. And so I was curious, would this around-the-world voyage, where we actually got to see the big blue marble, and where we were going to focus a curriculum, focus on sustainability that I got to help design and hire for, okay, could we change folks' worldviews? There is in the sociological literature a concept called the values, beliefs, norms hypothesis that says if you want to change norms, which is the predecessor of changing behavior, you need to think about changing values. All of this is literature that I'm not terrifically familiar with or wasn't at the time, but I've learned a lot. And there is a survey instrument, okay, that is possible to use to discern this change here. So the story I'm telling you today is essentially two stories. What did we do? And actually, I gave an hour-long talk on this a little earlier where I talked a lot about what we did. And then the empirical study that we use, which is more appropriate for today's focus on evidence of teaching and learning. So really two parts, sustainability on the voyage and then what the study itself did. Sustainability on the voyage, an integrated curriculum, okay? I'm trying to summarize 109 days here in, 12 minutes. I'm going to say it was composed of six parts. There's a required course that everyone on the ship has to take. It's called Global Studies. It meets pretty much every day on the voyage. We had a very gifted instructor for this, and you can see here, this is students working in this big, large lecture hall. They're working on the world population data sheet, and they're answering questions like, where can you find vodka on the world population data sheet? And you can find vodka in the increased mortality of Russian males over the last two decades. Okay. So he's asking people to engage with the data. We had elective courses. Roughly a fifth of the 90 courses had a sustainability focus, investing in a sustainable future, the business of saving nature, water for the world. These were all taught by talented folks, and that's my marine biologist giving a lecture out on the back of the ship. Can you imagine a better place to teach marine biology than out there? Field practica, a very, very important aspect of this, and there's a lot of literature that suggests that field experiences are an extremely powerful way to get students not only to know but to act. And if you want to change attitudes, if you're looking for a changer, they have to get their hands up close and feel it. And so this is the Agabloshi electronic waste dump in Ghana, in Accra, Ghana. It's pretty. You've seen it on some of the documentaries around there. And this, you walk through this and you see that there's a number of, well, there's 40,000 people that live there illegally, and they're, breaking down our waste to reuse it. It's really rather challenging there. Evening programs we had, we showed movies. We had a sustainability film series. We had explore seminars in the evenings. Our co-curricular activities included this as well. This is a recycled materials fashion show at the Sea Olympics that were going on. And then finally, each and every day, we had the dean's memo came out, and we exhorted our young people to walk the talk, and we tried to do this as well. So their water use on the ship is particularly important. You have to make all of your own water. It takes a lot of energy, so it's a very tight energy-water nexus, as well as just things as simple as keeping your curtains closed during the day. If you don't allow the heat in the ship, you don't have to expend energy to cool it. And this was one of the most powerful stories I can tell you, because about halfway through the voyage, after looking at the water use that had gone up and down over time, we were very concerned. We were using water at a high level. I actually, as in my role as dean, stepped into the global studies class and gave a short presentation, said, this is our water use that's going on here. And I exhorted them that perhaps they might think about reducing it in three ways, kind of humorously. I said, you could be like Josephine. Allegedly, the Emperor Napoleon wrote a letter to his beloved Josephine when he was about to visit her. He said, home in 3 days, don't bathe. I suggested we didn't need to bathe every day. We're on a ship, we're all friends, right? Or we could recall the old camp adage, right? If it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. Don't use the toilet so much. And finally, I suggested we could take Navy showers and had a student demonstrate how you could get in a shower, turn it on just to get wet, turn it off, soap up, and then turn it back on to rinse off, right? All just, these are behavioral changes. And what happened? That's the day I gave the talk. By the end of the voyage, water use had decreased by 30%. Okay, so we had behavioral change. The study itself, we used the New Ecological Paradigm Scale. As I mentioned, it's been done a few times. It is the most widely used instrument for measuring environmental attitudes in the world. We had several research questions dealing with face validity. We wanted to know some how ecological worldviews correlated with other aspects. And then mainly, did we move the dial? Characteristics of the sample population, pretty large. It's a matched pair sample. We gave samples before and after, so we really were able to measure change. The ship was primarily female. This is what happens on study abroad programs. This is not unusual. So our sample was primarily juniors, appropriate for this program. Pretty wide degree of disciplines, geographic regions, institutional sizes, and something called the sustainability report card score, which is perhaps worth noting. We took all of these, collected all this demographic information. The sustainability report card score is something that the Institute for Sustainable Endowments measures. All colleges and many colleges get these scores on a grade like you would, you know, A to E, what have you there. And UVA actually is doing not so bad right now with the B, but I was able to get these scores from all the different institutions, and you'll see why that might be important in a minute. What were the results? So comparing with other studies, we have this scale runs from plus 15 to plus 75, 75 being the strongest ecological worldview. And you can see before the voyage, on our pre-survey, our students fared pretty much at the high end of U.S. students. This was a very recent meta-analysis of 70 studies that allowed me to correlate with that. And at the end of the voyage, we moved the dial, but barely. Okay. So the overall NEP instrument, which is 15 questions, okay, reverse scored and out of there, yes, there was an advance, but it wasn't statistically significant. Okay, so that's the sad part. We were kind of hoping that we could take people out of their, okay, they've lived for 21 years in this environment, we take them out for 109 days, and their worldview would change. We didn't quite meet the standard of proof in a rigorous statistical fashion. However, we did learn a few things, which I think are worth sharing. First of all, with respect to demographic characteristics, if you haven't seen this information, this is perhaps interesting. We note that females rate higher than males. This is consistent with other studies. They have a greener, a more ecological worldview. There's a number of reasons for this. Carolyn Merchant, a leading feminist, ecofeminist scholar, suggests this may be because of the nurturing behavior of women in general, tend to nurture the young and nurture the planet. We found that students from the western regions, from California, were greener than the folks in the rest of the United States. That's perhaps not surprising as well, although studies have shown that shouldn't be the case, but we found it. And then we found that business majors were substantially browner. That is, they had a less ecological worldview. But that makes sense, because when you look at the DSP, that is practically axiomatic with the curriculum that we teach at McIntyre and Darden. So there's This is part of the raw results. What you see here is that although the overall instrument was not significant on the 15 items, we did find movement in five. So let's look at those. And I don't have time, of course, to go through the entire survey here, but what this slide will show that for these particular items, you'll see that the levels, they change. There are different strengths in each one of them. Okay, as you might expect, people have different amounts. And on the post-survey, there was positive movement in four of the 15 items. People acquired a statistically significant, more ecological worldview in these particular subsets of items. So although we weren't successful overall, within certain items we were. The voyage did change ecological attitudes. The one where it went backwards is this one. The Earth has plenty of natural resources if we just learn how to develop them. And we suggest, there's two suggestions for this. Number one, this is the single question out of all 15 that's been attacked as being a flawed question on the survey by other researchers. Secondly, if you sail around the world, you might think it's a pretty big place. I mean, it is. So you might actually think, yeah, if we just learn how to develop them appropriately is what the other researchers suggest, we can do it. We look through this, you find out that the biggest movement were on the anti-exemption. We're good. Okay. That we're not special, and also that more than humans count. So there was a movement as you sailed around the world. We saw this. We suggest this was really mainly the field program experiences that folks have, seeing folks in poverty, working in service learning projects, caring for orphans, painting homes, what have you, and then also many of the field programs, some of the ones I actually taught on the voyage and led programs. One of the most memorable was took students to the Kau Nature Preserve in Hawaii, where before we were allowed to enter the preserve, we had to wash our shoes off because we were concerned about invasive species, and we were also led in a prayer to the nature spirits, that we were led by a native Hawaiian guide and asked permission to go in the service. So you can see perhaps we're not as special as we think there. Changes in NEP scores and report card grades, this was interesting. So here what we found is when we looked at folks' scores from the above average schools, we found that there was a positive shift. This is the only element we found at all. And we argued that this case, the voyage may have built upon previous understandings that folks had had. Or we could have said we're kind of preaching to the choir, right? Folks who came from universities with a high report card or high level list got better as a result of things. And secondly, these folks here on the below average scores, the folks with C's and below, maybe they got religion. Maybe their eyes were open. This is what we were hoping for. Okay, so those two we can explain and we like it. This group here, however, and the average, I don't know. I don't have a very good explanation for this other than there are other things that are going on that determine environmental attitudes than just the demographic variables we measure. Okay? For instance, socioeconomic class and even political leanings have been shown to be correlated with that, and we didn't measure for that. We didn't control for that. So we don't know. There may be something else going on. That's what we did. Summarizing, around the world sustainability theme voyage. Our learning objective was nothing less than to change the worldview of the young people that were sailing with us. We had an integrated program about which more can be said, and if you're interested, we have some information there. And I'm going to justify the changes in attitudes, changes in latitudes with the survey evidence, the behavioral evidence, some anecdotal evidence, which I want to share with you right now. At the very end of the voyage, a lot of these students blogged, right? And so I knew some of them, I didn't know others. But this is a particular inspiring blog, I think, written by Chris Constantine, one of our voyagers. He writes, "Now let me share with you one word, sustainability. I cannot possibly share with you all that I have learned about our environmentally twisted planet from these past 4 months, but I can give you a summary. We're on the wrong track. The state of this planet, both environmentally and socially, is heading down a road that we probably shouldn't be on. Environmentally, the planet is heating up. Like a bowl of microwavable Easy Mac, bad things happen when you let it get too hot. To identify only a few concerns from the extensive list of issues, waters are rising, extinction is becoming too common, and many lives, both human and not, are at risk. Each day in the classroom, we were pummeled and overwhelmed with information regarding the unstable conditions of our planet. We saw current problems, potential future ones, and learned of catastrophic possibilities. I won't lie to you. We didn't stop global warming. We didn't eradicate hunger or end poverty. In fact, we may have only shot one tiny bullet in the battle for the improvement of our planet. But as the old saying goes, knowledge is power. It is. Trust me. What we learned from this program was all the weapons and coats of arms we need to have a chance in winning this fight. By arming us with knowledge for both now and the future, 586 students disembarked yesterday with a firm grasp on what needs to be done to support the soil we stand on. This is what you want to read in an end of class evaluation or an end of voyage evaluation. We just found it randomly on his blog. It was his last entry for the voyage there. That's the voyage at the end of it. I was fortunate to come back and miss some pictures of our favorite philosophers. I'm sorry, Sarah. Far too fortunate to come back and work with Sarah Peterson using this same survey, the NEP survey, to explore differences in environmental attitudes between students in Germany and students in the United States. And although we don't, you can see what's going on here, we had some hypotheses that U.S. students would be less inclined to have an ecological worldview than Germans. There's a stronger Green Party there. And actually, Sarah has information on we're more Lockean and they're more Rousseauian in terms of things. She's a politics major, and this is her honors thesis, and I want you to ask her questions about this. But we did a lot of work with this, and we found out we had all these hypotheses about differences between Germans and Americans, and really thought we'd be there, and I am so glad this is the last slide here. And what we found is sadly not enough differences, at least using this instrument, okay? You look at this and you say, yep, okay. Now, our sample here was just business students, so they were supposed to be the worst of the worst, right? We knew that. But it was a large sample size, and we didn't find a difference between NAEP scores of Germans or Americans. We did find that there was a difference on the one aspect, on the limits to growth. Do you believe that there are limits to growth, that there's a spaceship Earth? But it's the wrong way. We expected the Germans would be more aware of a limited environment. In fact, Americans, business students were. Confounding. But it's nice to know that women are the same all around the world. If you look at this, I know that's an overgeneralization, particularly looking at the thing. However, at least with respect to their green attitudes, this is one of the absolute strongest relationships is within ecological attitudes and gender, and we found that in every single one of those things. So thanks for your attention. Hopefully we're there, and afterwards you'll ask questions, and my colleagues will answer them. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Morse Mumaw, and I am a research associate professor in the School of Architecture, Urban and Environmental Planning. Today, I want to begin. Actually, I'm not going to use the clicker. I've decided I can talk faster than I can click. I can't talk and click at the same time. So if you'll bear with me, but this is the theme of my remarks. I want to begin, though, with a little story to set the stage. A number of years ago, my family and I attended a service at St. Paul's Memorial Church on the corner. And as the choir was singing one of the most majestic songs of the season, there was a momentary break in the music, and at which time a little voice from the back of the church rang out, E-I-E-I-O. Now, the parents' horror notwithstanding, that child spoke volumes about this topic today. We sing the song we know. We sing the song we know. But this morning, I want to start this conversation, and it really is the beginning of a conversation, I hope, on two levels. The first is the role of higher education to educate our students in the major issues of the world. We heard a lot about that, actually, from Mark's work. But the second thing is what we are learning in a new research project in the School of Architecture about how architecture schools might inform other disciplines and professions on singing this new song around engagement and problem solving. Let me just say that this work is informing one of our major research themes in the School of Architecture. It's funded by the Dean Summer Research Fund and the Kettering Foundation, and we think that we are discovering some things that will be helpful across grounds. Let me begin with the first point. Generally, higher education as a corporate body has lost its edge, in my opinion, as a major player in helping to mediate and direct the affairs of the world. This is not to say that our institutions, including this one, are not making contributions that help the world think about and begin to address some of its major issues. But the fact of the matter is, we are not leading the band anymore. To be as harsh as perhaps I could be this morning, let me say that higher education as a corporate body has become just another special interest group. However, the challenges that we face in this world of ours require, maybe even demand, that higher education be at the table. And that's what I want to talk about this morning. Mr. Einstein himself probably said it best when he said, Intellectuals solve problems. Geniuses prevent them. And this is where our thinking needs to be. Prevention trumps solutions. And we need to be preparing our students for just this path of thinking and doing. But the genesis of this talk rests in what we are learning in and from architecture schools across the country on new models of civic engagement. And it was based in part on a call to action, interestingly enough, by the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching, one of Lee Shulman's predecessors, Ernest Boyer, some of you know Ernie Boyer, wrote a book that Lee referenced this morning called Building Community, about the curricular changes that need to happen in architecture schools. His last point was, we need to prepare architects for lives of civic engagement. Now, what on earth does that mean, and how on earth are we going to teach it in the second place? And that's where the theme of this talk begins. It's the prepositional difference. And what that means, at least this morning, is it means that we work with communities. We don't do to them or for them. We work with communities on joint and valued work. It connects our students with real-world problems. It joins with people most affected by those problems. And last but not least, as Lee Shulman said earlier, it allows us, once we make a mess of the world, to work with the world to find the solutions and answers to the problems. It's the with, not the for or the to or the be. Now, how does it play out in architecture schools? You only have to look at my colleague John Qualley and the work he's doing with EcoMod on sustainable modular housing to know how it works in a real-world setting with students across grounds. Or look at my colleague Anselmo Canfero, who is, through his project Recover, is helping places most vulnerable to natural disasters have the materials they need to withstand that disaster. Look at Semester at Sea to get some answers and how this is done. Look at my colleague Ruben Rainey, who is working with terminally ill patients to design landscapes that are healing. Or my own work and Frank Duke's work in the audience, working with communities to help them find themselves answers to problems. So in our lingo, we think of this work in using four words: design thinking, build, engage, and capacity building. And I want to say just a word about each of those. Design thinking, to begin with. Through the work of Tim Brown at IDEO, the function of design has been given what Hannah Arendt might call an enlarged mentality. That is, we've moved beyond functionality or even aesthetics to a new way of thinking and doing that seeks solutions and prevention through design. In the great cities of the world, like Curitiba, Vancouver, or Berlin, we see the intersection of functionality, design, and the natural world. Design thinking. Building. Seattle architect Peter Steinbrück, who said to us in an interview, designers, that is, architects, urbanists, landscapers, have an extra skill set that is particularly beneficial to the improvement of the human condition. Skills like form, density, perspective are joined with adaptive use, sustainability, and imagination. A great example of how this works is found in the art and architecture of our medalist yesterday, Maya Lin. Build. Engagement. Perhaps the most overused word in the English language, second only to community. It's come to mean almost anything where a student or a faculty member has contact with a community member. Under this large umbrella, engagement, we include service, classroom projects, interviews with the community, applied research, and even the role of individual faculty and staff members in civic organizations. None of this is wrong, but too often it is only exposure to different cultures, contact with diverse groups, or service-related projects or initiatives that fill the gap of a local organization. Granted, it gives students real and valuable observation of how things work, but in fact, it doesn't move the needle at all. You may be asking, well, is this just not enough? The short answer this morning is no, it's not enough. And that's why capacity building enters our lexicon and the conversation, because it could be the cornerstone of what we're doing in the larger university. We are defining today capacity building as the transfer, modeling, information exchange, applied research, technical assistance, etc., that makes organizations, agencies, and individuals better prepared to acknowledge, to solve, and prevent the wicked problems that face our world. It's not self-help or a one-way street. Rather, it is a partnership between students, faculty, and community members where all are creative, innovative learners. The structure and enrichment of this kind of learning can take place in Charlottesville. It can take place in Southwest Virginia, and it can take place in South Africa. The point is this, to quote Einstein again, we cannot solve the problems of today with the thinking that created them. Based on the evidence thus far in this research project, this four-part framework of design thinking, building, engagement, and capacity building take us to a new tier of engaging with the broader world. Now, finally, we only have to look at the typology of problems to understand why this is important. I'll borrow from my friend Ron Heifetz at Harvard, who listed three. The first is a type 1 problem. That would be you've got a sore throat, you go to the doctor, he or she gives you amoxicillin, and you feel better the next day. The second kind of problem is heart disease or hypertension. It requires some sort of technical solution, a pill or so, but adaptive behavior on your part to exercise and watch your diet. But most of the problems that we all care about fall into the type 3 category. They require, by definition, adaptive work. Those are issues like poverty, hunger around the world, global sustainability, density, greenhouse gases, you fill in the blank of your favorite. Those are type 3 problems, and that requires a different kind of engagement by the university and a different kind of engagement by the professions and the disciplines. Cities, which I think about a lot, not states, not countries, not regions, will define the success or failure of the world's economy and its social structure. In just a few years, 70% of us will live in cities. It's critically important that they get it right and we get it right. The world's critical issues cannot be solved, or even adequately addressed if higher education is not at the table, and basically, if we don't ante up in a different way. So, in short, we need a new song for engagement. We're looking at it at the architecture school. We're learning from our colleagues across the country and the world. But we need to think about this in a much more deliberate way. Why? because it will better prepare our students to tackle the major issues of the day. It will allow our faculty to take research, evidence, and practice to communities and regions across this world that can be used and applied to prevent problems, not just solve them. And finally, this new approach will give our world a better chance not only to survive, but to be just, to be sustainable, and to give the future generations the support they need in every respect. We need a new song. Thank you.
I'm Ellen Bass. I'm a professor in the engineering school, and my collaborator, Susie Bruce, is actually tied up with another event today. And some of my other collaborators actually are teaching right now, so it's really tough to have things that fit in with the academic calendar. I'm really honored to come after our two fine panelists because their work is so large and so global, and it's impacting so many. And the work that Susie and I are doing is so small and underfunded, and it's just something we're doing because we want to. I guess one of the messages here is that, you know, all of these impacts don't have to be so large. You know, you don't have to be changing a whole city or bringing 500 students on a ship to actually have real impact. And the other piece I wanted to mention is that, you know, the engineers have this notion of being geeks and not getting it, but it's not really true. We're also part of these larger educational issues and actually have some insights to bear. And today I'm going to focus on a particular issue, which is bringing health promotion education into the engineering curriculum. And I wouldn't be able to do this work without Susie. So we're in the Curry School, and I thought I would be remiss if I didn't put up learning objectives on a slide. But I'm showing you this not because I really want you to read it, but if you look at what engineering objectives are, these are the usual suspects: equations, computer programming, building a widget, you know, those kinds of things. But I thought it might surprise you that we actually have what I would consider more global context learning objectives in the engineering school. And we have to, because our students are not going to build the next aircraft system all by themselves. They have to be able to work in teams. They have to have ethical responsibility and professionalism, as you can see in just the topics that we covered today. They have to be able to communicate. We can't let them slide, you know, pizza under the door and code comes out. You know, they really have to be able to communicate their issues. And clearly, they have to be able to work in a societal context and have knowledge of contemporary issues. We are not solving the problems from the 1950s. We're trying to solve the problems from the 2030s. And in fact, for most engineers, by the time you're my age, everything you know is obsolete because technology changes so quickly that, you know, our students actually know how to do things better than we do. I need to give you a little bit of background, and, you know, similar to most educators, we're involved in topics we really don't understand, and thank goodness I have Susie as a collaborator to help me. But one of the things I'd like to bring up, and actually we touched on norms a little bit today already, there's this notion that comes out of the social sciences called the social norms approach. And the idea is that if a group of people, like students, have a misperception, an exaggerated idea about behavior, like they think everybody's having sex, if they think everybody's having 10 drinks on a Saturday night, but really, most people have very safe behaviors, and very few people are having, you know, maybe 5 drinks on a Saturday night. If you actually publish the actual data over time, you'll see in a population that their behaviors actually get healthier. Because the person who thinks everybody's having 10 drinks might feel okay with their 7 or 8 drinks. But when they realize everybody else is only having 5, over time it causes them to change their behaviors. And that's the idea behind the social norms approach. I wanted to spend 20 seconds telling you what this, how you actually do a social norms marketing campaign. You have to collect data because you have to know actual behaviors and you have to know what people's perceptions are. Then you have to develop some messages like, hey, most people only drink only have five drinks on a Saturday night. When you're working with the student population, you have to ensure the credibility of the message source. And usually what happens in these campaigns is that there are focus groups with students before you actually go and put your materials out. And then, of course, you have to deliver your message, and then you have to do it a lot, year after year, semester after semester, to kind of drill it home. Now, this approach was developed by Haynes, and it's, if you're a social norms person, you're all over this. If you're an engineer, this is not how we normally do our work, and it's not usually the kind of methods we teach our students. But it turns out that I'm in human factors and in system engineering, and some of these concepts would be very similar to developing a new human-computer interface. So instead of collecting baseline data, you would try to understand the tasks that the person wants to do with that interface. And I see the human factors engineers nodding their heads, but it's true. Instead of developing a message, you have to figure out, well, what is that technology intervention that you want to develop, which could be a poster, but it could be a new interface. You have to ensure the credibility of the message. So for us, you'd have to ensure that that particular intervention is actually useful. Maybe you would do a little laboratory study or something like that. And then you have to deliver it, so you have to put your technology out in the field, and then you have to iterate. So although we don't actually do the social norms approach, it has some resonance in an engineering context. The other concept I have to introduce you to is something called curriculum infusion, which we already had a much better description of for the whole semester at C. Presentation, except curriculum infusion is a term that comes out of the health promotion area and focuses on substance abuse, but you could see the correlate in sustainability. And the idea is that you have a curriculum, and instead of just having somebody come in and give a lecture on a topic, you actually infuse the topic into the curriculum. So if someone's learning statistics, you have them analyze health promotion data. And of course, we saw a much better example with semester at C, where this and in the architecture school, where people are actually doing the work as part of their curriculum. But the idea here, and it shouldn't be too difficult, is that you have to actually have the academic faculty who are engaged in the courses do it. So Susie, for example, Susie Bruce at our Gordy Center for Alcohol and Substance Education, has to work with me to do curriculum infusion in my class, because she's not going to come in and teach an engineering lecture. It's just not going to work. So Susie and I, since 2005, have been targeting celebratory drinking, which is the polite word, I think, for binge drinking and hazardous drinking and drinking till you pass out, drinking so that it seems acceptable to pee on the side of a building, and the kinds of things that our students do and the things that we would like them not to do, or at least think about before they do, or to help each other not do. So we've been targeting Foxfield, we've been targeting the 4th year 5th, Halloween, things that we like to call celebratory drinking. And I used to call it binge drinking, but I don't anymore. I call it celebratory drinking. And the idea is that we could potentially do these social norms marketing campaigns and help students have safer behaviors over time without doing the just say no approach of, you know, our former president's wife. You know, not that those things are completely to be avoided, but they're not necessarily going to change behavior. So what I've been doing with Susie's help is developing pedagogical interventions that engage our students using health promotion ideas, and I've been doing it in two ways. Through our senior design projects. So our seniors have to do senior design projects, and it's a year-long activity. And I've been having them actually create and conduct and evaluate social norms marketing campaigns. And also through independent studies, because the students are really into it. And for some reason, I have these students volunteering to do independent studies on these projects. It really blows me away. But it's so exciting. And if I can get a student to do a Wilcoxon, you know, statistic or understand the difference between a paired t-test and a regular t-test, and they're actually approaching me to do it, I'm like all over that. And then the other thing we've been doing is curriculum infusion in our classroom through case studies. So I'm just going to touch on these. But the idea is that we actually give students homework assignments where they have to think about health promotion issues as well as engineering concepts. So our senior design project, this is just our website about our capstone project, but I just want to let you know the idea of it is for the faculty to go out and get a real sponsor and have our students design something, and it should be engaging. And so the work started with one of my capstone students who actually wasn't performing very well, and I ended up finding out that one of his friends had passed away in the summer. And so I was worried about him, and I went to the dean of students and somehow got hooked up with Susie, and we ended up targeting Foxfield, and my student actually developed a survey to collect the social norms marketing data for Foxfield. And this was back in 2006. And then after he collected the data, we developed a case study in my spring class. And students were so engaged that they actually spent their spring break helping me redesign the survey. And then we collected the data at Foxfield, or after Foxfield, all IRB approved, of course. And then one of the students stayed over the summer and analyzed the data. And a group of four students, five of whom who had helped me over that spring break, did their capstone project on a social norms marketing campaign for Foxfield. And I don't know if you remember seeing these signs hanging all over campus. There'll be a few this upcoming week focusing on safer behaviors. The other thing that we've been doing, as I said, is developing case studies for my actually, I'm not teaching this class anymore. Reed Bailey and Bill Shear are, but they let me steal one of the homework assignments to continue this work. And so we've been doing health promotion topics in our spring course. And what we do is we give them, all IRB approved, some of our data. And we give them a homework assignment, and we ask them questions like, are there any negative consequences of students drinking at Foxfield? And we give them a graded homework assignment. Now, this is not a beautiful slide, but this comes out of one of my students' homework assignments. And what the student is showing us are, first of all, they calculated blood alcohol content. And then they're doing a test comparing Foxfield to Halloween to a typical football game to a typical day of the week and looking at whether there's an increase or not in blood alcohol content across these groups. And it was just really exciting to actually see these students go to the trouble of creating this new measure, which we gave them a hint about, but they did it, and then actually, you know, plot the graph. And here's another example, a graph you would probably not expect to see in an engineering classroom about the negative consequences of alcohol on others, you know, and them showing us which of the particular negative consequences are really problematic, such as experiencing unwanted sexual advances. The other thing that we do to show reach is I'll ask the students, so who did you talk about when you were doing your homework assignment? And it's interesting, you'll see students raise their hand and say, well, actually, I talked with my friends in my sorority, or I talked with my... So these curriculum infusion ideas are actually having more reach than just in the classroom. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that we also have a learning assessment grant that through TRC and the Institute here to evaluate these approaches. And what we've been doing is we've been creating cases on other health topics. And so we did one on the fourth year fifth. We did a case in one class on fourth year fifth. We did another one on distracted driving. And one of the things I'd like to show you on this slide, which is that we actually got third-year system engineering students to admit that they learned something new about a topic which I was happy. So the gray and the black are, you know, that they agree or strongly agree that they learned something new. And it's really hard to get students to admit that they learn anything. And even better, that they change their behavior. So through one homework assignment, students are admitting that they're not texting while driving, or they're going to think about not texting while driving in the distracted driving case, or in the fourth year, fifth, taking preventive behaviors instead of drinking that fifth. I would also like to mention that based on these homework assignments, students continue to volunteer to do independent study projects with me. I have students working with our ADAPT group, which is the alcohol and drug abuse prevention team here on grounds. And I've been working to try to get other faculty involved in these topics. I also was invited to give a talk at the National Social Norms Institute last year in Philadelphia. I think I'm the first engineer they've ever invited. And from that, I was invited to give a presentation at Lafayette a few weeks ago, and I'm happy to report that they're actually going to copy our program with some of the math and science and engineering students there at Lafayette. So I was really excited. I think the learning assessment folks got their bang for the buck out of the $2,000 they gave us. So I'd also like to mention that our students are publishing. So this is one of the papers that was presented. I encourage fun titles. You know, here's another one. That first one was on the data analysis. This is on the social norms marketing campaign. And actually, at the end of the month, we're going to be doing a paper on the fourth year, fifth, penalty for excessive celebration, which is when you, you know, hot dog it after the at a football game. You know, if you score a touchdown and hot dog it, you can actually get a penalty. But this is actually about the fourth year, fifth, where students try to drink a fifth of alcohol on the day of the last home football game. And then our Halloween paper, Cavman, Wonder Woman, or Too Drunk to Tell, where we show that Halloween really is a celebratory event and some of the impact of our social norms marketing campaigns. Our students are actually having a tangible impact. So we're showing that if students who are exposed to some of the elements are more likely statistically to have safer behaviors, which is very exciting, both because they've been doing this work and also because they actually know when to use a t-test and what a degree of freedom is. And you know, I should say, everyone hates statistics. A lot of people hate statistics in the engineering school. It's a required class for our discipline, and it seems very dry. And getting the students to actually do it and do it well is just couldn't make me happier. So moving forward, we're really trying to create a culture of integrating health promotion topics, or in semester three, sustainability topics, different topics, into our science and engineering courses. We want to develop materials that actually integrate the topics into the class so that the students are actually learning their what I would consider engineering topics and other topics at the same time, and they don't even realize that it's happening, that we can actually engage other faculty to try it, and it's actually quite fun. And it's if you have a good partner, so in my case I have Susie, if you have a good partner, it's actually pretty easy to do. And the other message is that you don't have to do it all at once. So in our case, we could have students help develop a survey and pilot it in the classroom. The following year, a different group of students can analyze those data. A different group of students can develop the marketing materials. Another set of students can, you know, analyze the outcome of it and develop the information for the next year. And so we've been, over time, engaging different students in different parts of the project and continuing to do this work semester after semester after semester. So I'm going to end there because I know you told us not to go over our time. But the other piece I would just like to mention very quickly is that our students were interviewed on National Public Radio for this work. We were given some awards by NASPA, which is a student affairs organization. And so there's a lot of what I would consider unintended positive consequences that I've been having from this work that I never would have dreamed of. And I would also like to thank Neil Guha, who was a system engineering student on my capstone team whose friend passed, and he was brave enough to tell me what happened, and he was the one who started getting me into this work. It was because of him that I was able to work with Susie on Foxfield and get this program started. And I would like to also thank Virginia ABC and the TRC and the Institute for funding the work. I would also like to thank the Parents Program, who actually has given us some money to actually print some of our flyers, the Z Society, who somehow a check magically showed up in my mailbox to pay for some things. And moving forward, I'm looking for partners because we really want to write some grants to try to actually fund this work so we could actually put more effort into it. I think there's a lot of opportunity, especially in this hard sciences and engineering, for doing these kinds of curriculum ideas.
So why don't we have another round of applause for all three sets of presenters. We have about 15 minutes left, and the remainder of our time is meant for you in the audience to ask any questions or offer any comments to any one of the panelists. Anyone want to start us off?
I wanted to ask Mark and his team, if you were going to continue your study and try to get the results a little bit higher, how, what would you do? Would you extend the period of the voyage? Would you change one of the other components? What would you do?
Well, I guess as a student, I feel like there wasn't as much communication necessarily before and after the two survey times. I mean, there's a lot of education.
Did you do a midway survey while they were on the ship?
Sorry?
Did you do a midway?
No, there wasn't a midway survey.
Yeah.
There's just a before. Yes. But we definitely learned a lot. But as the anecdote said, that we were kind of pummeled with information, and so there's definitely a missing link between like the information and then the behavior change. So I guess, I don't know if you have anything else to say about that.
More learning by doing. That's, if having done it once, it was nice to know that it worked in this aspect, but I think the more hands-on we can tie it, the more effective it would have been. We certainly had opportunities. We just didn't take advantage of all of them.
Question in the back.
So I could piggyback on that, but first I want to thank the whole panel, from Suzanne, for really challenging what is the role of the university. Really what you're asking and then answering, it's a clarion call, and then Ellen for your just really intriguing work. And Mark and your team, wondering, the survey you use forces people into choices that may not really reflect what it is they're learning. And that I think what you're probably trying to do is to actually teach them that there's an integration. That you can't have a certain type of development without taking into consideration the natural resources. And that instrument is fairly old, and I'm wondering if it actually gets to that question. And I have a feeling that if you had some other, I was trying to think of how you might frame other questions of that, given this trend, can we have the quality of life that we want to have, or something that might be able to do that. I have a feeling, I would assume we would just get better.
Well, yeah, so in designing the experience, so I knew I wanted to have an assessment when I went on the voyage, okay? I went to my colleague, who's a marketing research person who really knows how to do survey research. I don't. And the first thing she said is, you don't want to develop your own survey, because there's professionals that do that, and you have to validate things. There's a whole lot that goes into it, survey design. So she said, look for a well-accepted instrument that might come close to looking what you're looking for. And so that NEP survey, which measures worldview, although it's old, it is the most well-accepted. There are over 100 studies that have used this in various things. And so that's why I landed on that, because what I really would like is more of an up-to-date, better understanding of the more complex of sustainability there. All I really had was kind of spaceship Earth piece. That's why I did that, because I'm not that gifted at the design. There's someone who should do that, but in order to get robust results, and frankly, yeah, anyway, that's.
And I think your anecdotal evidence is indicating change.
Yeah.
Also, the survey was originally developed in 1978, but it was revised by the authors in 2000.
In 2000.
So it has been slightly updated.
In light of the conversations, and I enjoyed them immensely, is there are two things that I seem to hear, and one is that the quantitative data is particularly helpful in terms of social discussions, but that there's a qualitative research element to this that I think gets to some of the data that that actually speaks to some of the social norms. You know, I come from the School of Medicine, and we do continuing medical education, and one of the big issues is how to deal with oxycodone abuse in rural areas, which you'll hear from me. But I think, you know, and I think about architecture, and when we look at smoking cessation and obesity, civic layout of communities and cities and those kinds of things have huge implications. So, but I think there's a piece of inquiry that qualitative data gathers and gives the students, being a nurse myself originally, I was plummeted with information, and you learn the data really well. What I don't think you always get the opportunity to do is to reflect on it in a way that makes it your own. And so in all of these experiences, it seems to me that as we look to be, to Suzanne's point, as we look to being the leader, it takes us back to the thinking, and the engagement. And that's the part about the system, about the Fox Hill Project that I'm fascinated by, because it had immediate relevance. They understood it, they knew the environment, they actually were empowered to find a decision. So, what other kinds of, are there ways that we can, because you guys are involved in those projects, expand or consider ways that break down some of our silos that we're all pretty comfortable in to really explore those ideas.
I wanted to add one more comment besides the qualitative data, and I actually should have put it in my presentation. One of the things that I find very useful is if the topic that you pick has that immediate impact, but also that the person who you're targeting is somehow a partner and not a student. So what's nice about fourth year fifth, and what's nice about architecture and local UVA sustainability, is that our students are experts in student culture, and they're experts in how the university works. And so in my case, for example, I analyzed Foxfield data, and I noticed that there was first-year males not drinking at Foxfield, and I could run the MANOVA, and I could test for normality, and I could do all the stuff you're supposed to do, but I couldn't figure it out. My students were like, the fraternities make their pledge brothers drive. That's why, Professor Bath. And I was like, that totally makes sense. So I need the students to be partners on, and Susie echoes this, and that what makes a lot of our work successful is I'm not telling the students what to do. They're not just students. They're actually my partner, and we engage them in that way, and we pick topics that they're interested in, and we're picking, and not because of their, not just their interest, that we couldn't do the work otherwise. So if we can pick topics that is your local community because you're living there, it's not only that you're engaged, it's that you understand that on trash day, the trash blocks the parking and you can't get there, and therefore it causes people to litter more. And if they would just change the timing of the trash removal to not be at a certain time of day, it would eliminate a problem. Well, our students figured that out when they were lining up in front of the church the morning of Foxfield, and they were hanging out waiting for the buses, and the buses were so late, and they were eating and drinking while they were waiting there, and then the place was destroyed, and the university had to clean everything up before it was, you know, time for the church people to come. And, you know, the solution was, well, perhaps if you actually put trash receptacles there, they could just haul them off. And then the following year, they put a dumpster there, and the problem was solved. And the students helped us understand that issue very well.
If I can just build on that from the architecture school, I see our dean, Kim Tanzer, in the back. Kim, disagree with me if you are so inclined. The reason this work is important for us in the architecture school is exactly what Ellen said. The students are pushing this. I mean, we're faculty and we're interested, but you don't have to look very closely to know that, as someone said to me the other day on the plane, your glasses are retro. I said, I am retro. That's why my glasses look retro. Our students are pushing us in much the same way that Ellen is describing, not just in Charlottesville, although there's a lot of work in Charlottesville from the various projects I mentioned, but across the world, and they are itching for us to make more progress on these issues. And so as we're thinking about not only our pedagogical approach, but also how to connect them in different ways, I think we're learning a lot. So I deliberately put in my remarks that faculty, students, and community members are working together to be creative learners. So I think the short answer to the anecdote and qualitative information is our students are pushing us to innovate. And I don't mean just architecture students now. I teach a course with students across grounds. I was telling Mark walking over, I don't know that I have ever been so stunned to know how much, to view and understand how much they already know. You know, one of the issues of institutions like ours, one of the challenges is how much value added can we give them? They come in, they're so smart and so well connected. So I think the question for us is, how can we follow the lead, not of other faculty members, although we want to congratulate ourselves on that, but how are we going to follow the lead of our students who are pushing us strongly? Now, Kim, you disagree. If you,
I don't. I totally agree. But I also see another connection between these three presentations, and I would like to congratulate all of you for your roles in making this happen and hope that after the inauguration we can continue to have these kind of cross-ground conversations. One of the things that I see as an important connection, Ellen, is that you have recognized that your students have the expert knowledge that's necessary to make that change. And I think that in the work that I know Suzanne does and that some of it Mark as well, working with our colleagues in architecture, do we know that community members are experts, but drawing out their knowledge to help us help in some ways improve circumstances that they find themselves in is also really important. And I feel that in our discipline, in architecture, we do it in a kind of an ad hoc way oftentimes. And I'm wondering if there are tools that you have developed, and you may not be able to talk about those today, but that would help to be more explicit about how we see community members as partners, research partners, rather than as subjects of good works, which doesn't play well, as those of us who do this work know pretty well. So that's one kind of learning we can do from each other. And the other thing that I wanted to observe is that I think tying this work back to known knowledge bases, and I was, Mark, Carolyn Marchand is one of my favorite writers, and I don't think I've ever heard her cited in an academic context before, so thank you, except among feminists, so thank you. And also Hannah Arendt. Absolutely. And I also, I can't remember who spoke about, well, I think learning by doing and Dewey's work, I guess that was our keynote speaker this morning. I think that for us to understand how this new, it's not a new kind of education, but I think that we're all kind of talking about the relationship between effective learning and learning in an experiential context, but I feel like that's a big gap in our knowledge base if we want to really be.
I'm also mindful of the time. I know several of us, including myself, have to be in a session in 10 minutes. So I'm sorry to wrap it up because I know there's more questions. If the panelists can stay and you don't have another application, perhaps you might be able to answer individual questions as well. Thank you so much, everyone. I'm sorry we have to cut the conversation short. We really need a whole extra session just for questions, I think.